On 104.5 FM, this is WRFU LP Urbana. It's 6 p.m. on Thursday, and time for A Critical Ear, presented by Andrew O'Boyle and Robert Naiman. And good afternoon and welcome to the show. Bob is on assignment. Bob is in Denver, Colorado at the moment, and he's attending and reporting on covering the Democratic National Convention. He'll be joining us on the phone in just over 10 minutes time. So we hope you'll stay tuned and appreciate that live on the ground report we're going to bring you here on WRFU. From the Democratic National Convention, or rather, the outside of the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado. My name's Andrew O'Boyle, and welcome to A Critical Ear for another Thursday afternoon. It's just a little bit after 6:15. I'm going to start off with the panel's in London News Bulletin for today, the 28th of August, and then move on to other items. Still starting with that news bulletin. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has described floods in the eastern state of Bihar as a national calamity. Food riots erupted on Wednesday as hungry flood victims fought for limited food supplies. Over 2 million people have fled their homes in what officials say are the worst floods in 50 years. At least 50 people have been killed. The government says 1 million tons of rice and wheat will be distributed to stranded people. The River Kosi breached its banks last week and flooded huge areas of the state. Torrential rains have killed more than 1,000 people in South Asia since the monsoon began in June. A bribery scandal has rocked the US military in Afghanistan. Two US troops and a group of contractors have been arrested on charges of bribery and conspiracy. Those indicted face up to 15 years in prison and a fine of up to $500,000 US dollars for bribery, and up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000 for conspiracy. U.S. authorities say individuals and companies who corrupt the bidding process for procurement in Afghanistan will be aggressively prosecuted. More than 70 migrants are feared to have died when their boat sank in the sea south of Malta. 8 people were plucked alive from a half-sunken dinghy. The tragedy comes a day after 30 other people drowned as they attempted to reach Spain. Each year, thousands of desperate people take to the seas in search of better lives in Europe. Few live to tell the tales of hunger and death in overcrowded boats. Europe is getting tough with migrants washing up on its shores. Those caught can now be detained for up to 18 months and face a 5-year re-entry ban. Thousands of Iraqi students will now attend state-owned schools in Jordan for free. Jordan has waived annual fees for the students regardless of immigration status to help them cope with rising living costs. Iraqi children without proper immigration documents have so far been barred from state schools. Those with residency permits had to seek special permission to attend. The policy left many Iraqi students without an education. Of the 500,000 Iraqis believed to be living in Jordan, at least 360,000 do not have valid residency permits. Thousands of people living around the largest lake in Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, are set to lose their homes and livelihoods. The lake is being filled in to make way for property development. Many of the residents own homes and thriving businesses serving tourists. But the local government has leased the land to a property developer who wants to build shopping centres and housing. Residents protest that their rights have been ignored and the compensation is too low. Housing rights organisations also claim the deal between the city and the developers amounts to an illegal use of state land. And finally, the Nigerian government says at least 33 universities are operating illegally. 5 promoters of the institutions have been arrested, according to the National Universities Commission. A government official said all unlicensed universities will be shut down. Private education is huge business in Nigeria. It has 93 universities, and of these, 34 are private. Many more operate illegally. Interworld Radio headlines are provided by Interworld Radio, the daily news and feature service from the Panos Institute, London. More information at www.panos.org.uk and www.interworldradio.net. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Centre, or Urbana Socialist Forum. Feedback is welcome at show@acriticalear.info. More information at acriticalear.info. And up next, what we're going to take you to is a piece from the International Middle East Media Center. In the past week, there have been a small convoy of boats breached what is essentially a blockade on the Gaza Strip, preventing the traffic of goods in and out of there. And there was an international, mini convoy that breached that and that got to Gaza last week. And so going to bring you that piece from the International Media, the International Middle East Media Center, covering that event. Last Thursday or Friday that this actually occurred.
Thousands of Palestinians went to the Gaza beach to welcome the two boats coming from Cyprus, organized by the Free Gaza Movement in an initiative to break the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip for almost 1 year. The two boats arrived into the Gaza port, and a number of Palestinian fishermen and boats actually welcomed the internationals who are aboard the two boats. The two boats, Gaza Free and SS Liberty, have left Cyprus 2 days ago after they have managed to get all the required permissions from the Siberian government, and they have allowed them to leave their beach or leave their waters to go to the Gaza Strip. The Free Gaza Movement have sent a letter of invitation to the Israeli government, represented by the Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, who responded later by saying that they recognize that the goal of the two boats is humanitarian and that they will allow them to enter the Gaza Strip. Conflicting statements were heard later by other Israeli officials, especially military officials, who said that they might intercept the boats. The organizers of the campaign expressed fear that any interception of the boats could result in a disastrous end. Eventually, the two boats arrived into the Gaza Strip Saturday at 6 p.m. And we have Rami El-Mighari, IMEMC's correspondent, in the Gaza Strip, describing the scene on Gaza port. If you can describe the scene at the Gaza beach and the crowds that are there to welcome the two boats that arrived from Cyprus.
We actually say maybe more than 2,000 people are gathering on the Gaza air, in the Gaza port right now on Gaza. I'm welcoming the crowd, welcoming the Gaza international human rights activists and aid workers who are coming to Gaza to break the blockade. Finally, the activists have made their way to Gaza, and they are now on Gaza air, on Gaza port, on Gaza land, and they are being welcomed by crowds of people, crowds of besieged Gaza population here in this part of the Gaza Strip. It's really a very remarkable moment for the Gaza population, for those who are supporting Gaza particularly, and this is really a sort of cheerfulness by the crowds here in the Gaza Strip who are coming here to welcome these international activists. And this is really, you can't describe, can't imagine how the people are cheerful, how the people are happy for welcoming these internationals who are coming to Gaza today to break the international blockade. What is remarkable also about this visit of these internationals is their ability to come to go through the Gaza Sea despite the Israeli claims and the Israeli threats against these internationals. As you know, that the Israelis have warned of forcefully preventing these people from entering Gaza. And it is really remarkable that they have finally made their way to the Gaza Strip through Gaza Sea and Gaza shores.
Rami, it was expected that the Israeli army would blockade or stop the boats. However, they apparently allowed them after a meeting between Olmert and his foreign minister.
Actually, I don't hear you. Please repeat again, because there is a lot of crowd here.
Okay, a meeting between Olmert and Tsipi Livni came out with a result to allow the boats to come. But what is the significance of that two boats full of international peace activists coming into the Gaza port without, you know, going through Israeli security checking or passport control or whatever?
Okay, well, let me just say that Gaza's population is not only those who are governing Gaza. Gaza's population are mostly civilians, and they are besieged and they are blockaded. This is a real and given fact in the Gaza Strip here. And I think the significance of the Israeli decision to allow these people in can be summarized in Israel, maybe through my own analysis and other analysts, that can be summarized in Israel's willingness to avoid international media campaigns against Israel, because Israel has been enforcing a crippling or a debilitating blockade on the Gaza Strip for more than a year now. And also, let me just mention one important fact, that these people who are coming to Gaza are just some sort of human rights activists and aid workers, and their mission is a humanitarian one. Their mission is a fully humanitarian one. So Israel, I think Israel has no Israel sees no major threats, no major warning. That's why Israel allows these people in, and by so doing, Israel has avoided a sort of international campaign or sort of media pressure on the Israeli state, besides the media campaigns that has preceded the arrival of this boats to the Gaza Strip.
So, what do you think of that? Would this be a precedent? I mean, like, would other boats or this pave the way for other ports or for shipping movement to start or to resume to the Gaza port?
Actually, it depends. It depends on the situation, and depends on the situation, because this precedent has not taken place before. This is the first time that these internationals come on boats on Gaza shores. And I think next time this will depend on the significance of such visits to the Gaza Strip. You know, this is the first humanitarian visit to the Gaza Strip by international activists, and this is really it's going to be repeated, but I don't think that Israel will allow more shippings or more shipments to the Gaza Strip. You know, these boats came for the first time under a very debilitating, crippling blockade on Gaza, and the significance of their arrival particularly is their ability to break the siege, to break the blockade, their justice and their request to come to Gaza to relieve the people of Gaza under a debilitating blockade.
Do you have an idea what is planned upon arrival, like after they arrive to the Gaza Strip? What is planned by the Popular Committee to break the siege?
The Popular Committee for breaking the siege is undertaking the reception ceremonies for these ports. These boats into Gaza, and jointly with the international campaign, Palestinian campaign for breaking the siege. These two parties are welcoming and undertaking the reception ceremonies for these boats into Gaza. And the Popular Committee for Breaking the Siege, particularly, is undertaking the popular welcoming of these boats to Gaza.
That was Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC's correspondent in Gaza Strip, talking about the two boats that arrived into the Gaza Strip today, Saturday, August 23rd at 6 p.m. And he described the situation on the Gaza port and the welcoming of the people, the popular welcoming of the people, and some other notes about the arrival of these boats. Thank you for being with us for constant updates about the situation in Palestine and the Free Gaza movement. Please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This is George Ishmawi from the International Middle East Media Center in occupied Bethlehem in Palestine.
And that was a piece from the International Media Center in the Middle East, or the International Middle East Media Center, an IMC center covering the arrival of a mini convoy of two boats arriving from Cyprus into Gaza and breaking a year-long blockade that has been in effect there, as you might expect, for the past year. On the line now, I believe we have our roving correspondent, Bob Naiman. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And you are currently in Denver. How is it in Denver, Colorado today?
It's beautiful. The weather is beautiful. And as you can imagine, there's quite a buzz here as it's the last day of the Democratic Convention. And Senator Obama is preparing to give his speech at Vesco Field, 75,000 people. I'm actually in the Mercury Cafe, which is a beautiful little coffee shop that has been the headquarters all week for Code Pink and a kind of activist center. There's been Green Party stuff here and anti-war stuff. So this is my vantage point. I just did an interview with KPFK in Los Angeles talking about the foreign policies being promoted at the Democratic Convention. So a whirl of activity.
Wonderful. On that first issue of the foreign policies, one of the things that you noted in yesterday's Just Foreign Policy News News Digest was Denis Kucinich's speech to the convention. Something that I think perhaps predictably didn't get quite as much coverage as some of the other as some of the headline events, but quite an interesting, quite an eloquent speech, and one in which he called for the next administration, which he hopes will be an Obama administration, to reaffirm the United States' commitment to international law, or to bring the United States back to a commitment to international law and international norms.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. The first thing I want to point out is that it did actually get some attention. I first became aware of it because it was the top thing on Yahoo News. It was the top headline on Yahoo News, and it was something like, Kucinich speech electrifies convention. So, you know, that got my attention both because of the content of the headline and where it was. You know, it wasn't like some lefty blog. That was the Yahoo News, you know, whatever it was, AP or Reuters headline. And so then I went over and said, okay, what are people saying about this? I went over to Daily Cost, which is, a kind of progressive Democratic blog, which is very much Obama territory, not Kucinich territory. That's my experience over the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction there was very positive. Lots and lots of positive comments of people to Kucinich's speech, and there was other press coverage that was like that wire story, convention electrified, you know, standing ovation, and so on and so forth. So then that was very positive. On the question of international law, of course, it caught my attention because, as you know, this is an issue that I'm particularly focused on, trying to confine the United States in the box of international law. And it's a remarkable but not surprising fact about the country that we live in that the notion that the United States is bound by international agreements such as the United Nations Charter, is completely absent, almost completely absent from political debate and discussion. And people just aren't even, a lot of people, I'm sure, are not even aware of the fact that at the end of the Second World War, this institution was created called the United Nations, and its founding document is called the UN Charter. And practically the first thing it says in the UN Charter is that UN member states will not militarily attack other UN member states, and they won't even threaten to attack them, also a violation of the UN Charter. And the only exception to that UN Charter is immediate self-defense or military actions that are authorized by the UN Security Council. So the fact, for example, that the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a violation of international law was, as George Tenet would say, a slam dunk. And that was affirmed by Secretary General, now former Secretary General, Kofi Annan. The invasion of Iraq was illegal. And in other parts of the world, this is considered an important fact. But in the United States political discussion, it's completely missing. And the joke that I sometimes tell about this, I don't know if I've told it on Newswire so far, but your friend says to you, "Oh, I saw this great speech today by a member of Congress. He was talking about how the invasion of Iraq violated international law." Then, your response is, "Oh, you saw a speech by Dennis Kucinich," because it's probably of the 435 members of the House, 100 members of the Senate. He's practically the only member of Congress that talks about international law. It talks about the fact that the United States has binding legal obligations as a member of the United Nations, as a signatory of the UN Charter, which the United States helped draft. I mean, the very reason that the United Nations was created was in order to create this binding prohibition against the use of military force. So the fact that, this is completely dismissed in the U.S. political context is kind of irrelevant, something that only leftists care about is something very troubling. So I was very excited to see that that Kucinich said this in his speech. In his list of, in his litany of crimes of the Bush administration, he cited the violation of international law. And obviously I want to highlight that, because I think, this list of things to do is pressing for more of this. It should be the case that when members of Congress, other people, speak out against the war in Iraq, this should be in the litany of charges. And this was a violation of international law. I pointed out in the blog that I wrote about this yesterday, that which is on Common Dreams Today, that Democrats frequently criticize the Bush administration for having ruptured relations with Europe, with allies and the international community, with the invasion of Iraq. And that's absolutely true. But it finesses this very important point. Why did it rupture relations? Why did it alienate the international community and allies? Because the United States thumbed its nose at international law and the UN Charter. That's why. In addition, of course, to the destruction. But what did it mean when the Bush administration made its case to the UN Security Council, and the UN Security Council did not accept the Bush administration's case, and the Bush administration proceeded to war anyway, thereby violating the UN Charter. So this is something I think we should all be working towards the next several years, to try to bring this into debate, this key fact. This is part of, people want the United States to rejoin the international community. This is part of rejoining the international community. It's recommitting to the UN Charter.
I think even during the years of the Bush administration, we saw quite an appeal to, it was somewhat stronger in terms of the foreground of rhetoric, but the United States being spoken of, the core tenets being law and order, a country of laws, and this is, not just that laws within the country, but that the laws that countries set up between themselves that frame what sort of action is permissible and how action shall take place.
Yeah, it's something that's at the margins of consciousness, that, there's very little discussion about international law in the United States, at least as it applies to the United States. you know, we saw, and we spoke last week about how when Russia moved into Georgia, thereby violating Georgian sovereignty, because that, you know, the territory that they moved into is internationally recognized as being, that's Georgia, that's not Russia. And even South Ossetia and Abkhazia, whatever their perhaps quite legitimate grievances against the government of Georgia, international law, it's part of Georgia. And it's not, you know, it's not Russia's place, at least as far as international law is concerned, to unilaterally decide that they're going to police Georgia. Well, that's something that people in the United States don't have any trouble understanding, because that's, you know, it gets hammered in the news media. But that the flip is true, that, you know, the same rules apply to the United States, that's almost completely missing from discussion. So people talk about, you know, the United States should rejoin the community of nations, and that's positive, but rejoining the community means, you know, accepting that you're going to follow the rules of the community. That's how you leave the community, is by you stop following the rules of the community. And that's what the United States did in 2003. Of course, arguably, it wasn't the first violation, but it was a particularly spectacular violation at a time when, you know, over time, the world is getting more and more intolerant towards these violations. So that's how they left the international community. So in order to rejoin it, they have to rejoin the rule.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, kind of, this is moving back to Denver and away from policy for a moment. You're quite familiar at this stage, I think, with various different protest events and different spectaculars around which activism occurs. How does this event compare? And I kind of give you a number of directions in which I'd imagine one might compare it, is in terms of the numbers of activist presence, the atmosphere, or the kind of the mindset of the activists. And also, I know I've seen reports of some arrests taking place in Denver, but not too many. Is there much concern about either about the repression of protest? I know that there's talk of protest cages, which are, you know, free speech cages, essentially, where protests are confined to.
Yes. So to take your last point first, yes, there is a protest cage here in Denver that has been largely, although not completely, shunned by activists, because it's almost completely invisible to anyone outside the cage. So why would you want to have a protest there? And a big part of the protest is, the point of having a protest is to be seen by others, not just the people in your demonstration. Code Pink actually did have a protest there, and I put the video on YouTube, that Code Pink people singing No Blood for Oil. But by and large, people, you know, over 99% of the protests have happened outside the protest cage, and that's been completely ignored and abandoned. There have been quite a few protests here. Of course, I'm not even aware of all of them, but Code Pink has done actions every day. Iraq Veterans Against the War has had several demonstrations. There was an immigrant rights march this morning. I would say that compared to, you know, Seattle or the IMF World Bank protests in Washington in 2000, there's definitely fewer protesters here, partly because, you know, many people who consider themselves peace activists in the United States are actually quite hopeful or modestly hopeful that Senator Obama will be the next president, and maybe they're not necessarily super eager about being associated with protests, particularly if, you know, they have the perception that it's going to be kind of, you know, confrontational, as some of the high, kind of pre-hype was. But also you have the fact that, you know, the RNC is happening in Minneapolis, St. Paul next week. So I know, for example, that many people in Urbana were like, okay, well, Minneapolis, St. Paul is closer, it's RNC, so why not just go there? And so there's a much bigger mobilization happening from Illinois, from Chicago, and from Illinois to go to the RNC. Certainly more attractive targets, closer, easier to get there. Nonetheless, what the scene here to some degree has in common with those other things is that there has been a militarized police presence. So even on the first day, you know, walking down the street, completely peaceful protests with Code Pink and others, you see the line of police with their shields, you know, and their ninja outfits. And
I've heard
really
tell of police.
Why is this necessary for protesters who are obviously peaceful and nonviolent and not armed?
Mm.
And there have actually been some incidents of repression. So, for example, a Code Pink protester who was actually taking a picture of another protester being subdued by police. She was then struck and knocked down by police, and then she herself was trying to tell journalists what had just happened to her. And in the middle of that, police broke into the gaggle of journalists and dragged her away and arrested her. And that video of everything that I just described is on the net. It's on, I think, Common Dreams today. I'm sure it's in other places.
It is indeed.
And I understand. I don't know this for certain, but I understand that policeman who struck that Code Pink woman has been removed from interaction with the public duty, and the incident is under investigation. As happens, you know, when these things are captured on video. So it's definitely the case that there have been issues of repression here, although, you know, the scale is perhaps not as great as other places, but there's definitely been complaints about restricting space for protest and about how protesters have been treated, how nonviolent protesters have been treated by the police.
On that point, there's two things that I've heard, and perhaps you may or may not want to comment on one or both. One is that among the many weapons that I've heard tell of the police having, there are rumors that some of the police are armed with nunchucks, which seems a decidedly unusual weapon, if it be the case. The other is, and this is something that frequently we see in situations like this, I think, is that I've seen video of various police officers who are there are lines of police, none of whom are wearing their identification numbers. Usually this is the case that each police officer will have an individual number, and therefore if there's any incident involving them, they're identifiable from that. But various in riot gear or whatever, with the faces covered and also unable to be identified due to not having their police numbers or police identification present. Have you seen instances of that, or have you heard about this?
I haven't seen that particular thing. The protests that I've been in so far, actually, the police were fairly tame and even friendly. And as is often the case, often or always the case, with these things, you have a tremendous mix. You know, you have some, just like you have some protesters that are really hungry for whatever reason for a conversation with the police, there's some police that are really hungry for a conversation with protesters. And the overwhelming majority of protesters and police are not interested in that kind of confrontation because, you know, the overwhelming majority of police are just trying to do their jobs and keep order. And the overwhelming majority of protesters are trying to get a message out about justice in the world, not, you know, attack cops. But you have, you know, you have a minority on both sides that, you know, ruins things for everyone or makes things harder for everyone. So, and I think, you know, we've seen a little bit of that in Denver this week.
Mm-hmm.
But the overall story, I think, has not been one, certainly, you know, talking to people or looking at the local press here, has not been one of confrontations between protesters and the police.
That's good. One of the things you mentioned is that one of the reasons why the crowds may not be quite as large in terms of the activists on the street
is because many of those who might otherwise see themselves as activists or who might otherwise be engaged in protest are hopeful that in this election Obama will win against McCain. And one of the things I wondered on that, there's a report out from Pew today, from the Pew Research Center. I'm not sure, you may not have seen this, but their headline is Obama's background better known than his issue positions. And very much the case that people, by about a 10 to 15% margin, feel that they know more about Obama's personal background and his life story than they do actually about his foreign policy positions or his economic positions feelings, and they feel slightly more informed on his economic positions. We've talked before a little bit about the horse race issue of the way that elections are looked at. How would you characterize, say, Obama's position on foreign policy, and do you think that it's reasonable, this is people self-reporting, that we feel we don't know as much about foreign policy or his foreign policy positions as we know about his family. But do you feel, is there a sizable gap there between what people think Obama stands for and what he actually does? And how would you characterize Obama's positions on foreign policy?
Well, I would say, first of all, I think there is a very meaningful, significant distinction between what Senator Obama is saying, Senator Obama and other leading Democrats are saying, and what Senator McCain and other leading Republicans are saying. Meaningful, important differences that will have serious consequences in the world. That by no means means that I endorse all of the things that Senator Obama and other leading Democrats are saying. Some of the things that they're saying are awful. But that there is a huge and important distinction I regard as obvious. So, for example, Senator Kerry, the 2004 presidential nominee, in his speech to the convention, slammed Senator McCain and President Bush for making fun of Obama and other Democrats for wanting to talk to Iran. And Senator Kerry pointed out quite correctly that shortly after Bush gave this speech in Israel where he said, basically the people who want to talk to Iran are appeasers like, Chamberlain in Munich. Shortly after that, the Bush administration announced that it was sending one of its top diplomats to negotiations with Iran that were taking place with Europe. So even President Bush is now, to some degree at least, carrying out the very policy that Bush and McCain have lampooned. I think that's a very, very, very significant and important distinction, the fact that you have leading Democrats standing firmly on the policy that we need to engage Iran, even as Iran is playing the role to some degree of demon of the month. That's been interrupted a little bit by Russia jumping on the stage and becoming demon of the month. On the downside, of course, even just speaking of the issue of Iran, you have also leading Democrats repeating kind of Republican talking points about Iran that are not in fact true. So, for example, Senator Kerry, in that same speech, which overall, said many good things and made many good points, Senator Kerry asserted as fact, as known fact, that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapon. Well, that's not a known fact. That's an accusation. That's an allegation. Senator Kerry may believe it, but it's not a known fact. It's not borne out by the reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the international body under the United Nations, which is charged, formally charged, with investigating this question. They have not said this. Iranian leaders have never said that they they're pursuing nuclear weapon. And on the contrary, they said the opposite, that they're not doing it. They have no interest in it. So on and so forth. So again, I can't prove, nobody can prove question of intention. You could disagree, and there's no way to prove that they don't intend at some point in the future to pursue nuclear weapons. But there's no evidence today that they have a nuclear weapons program, that they are underway to have a nuclear weapons program. So that's of significant concern that someone like Senator Kerry the same time that he's correctly bashing the Republicans for their pig-headed, ostrich-like opposition to any negotiations, diplomacy, or engagement, at the same time, he's affirming their false talking point that everybody knows that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons.
And it seemed to me, from watching the Kerry speech and other pieces recently, to a certain extent, what's being stressed is a return to a form of liberalism associated with the Democratic Party in terms of assertion of U.S. power being at the heart of the policy. Now, this is, of course, you know, what we've seen with the Bush administration has been a form of neoconservatism that has given a conservative version of that kind of U.S. interventionism, U.S. Global dominance. But it seems to me that what's been happening is rather than rowing back and towards a more communal approach towards peaceful relations with other nations is something that pulls back to older versions of relying on U.S. dominance and kind of Bush is doing it wrong. We'll do it in a way that that obeys law, but that is still based on that notion of a unipolar powerful U.S.
Yeah, well, I partly agree, except depends what you mean by unipolar. I mean, the distinction of whether or not you're going to act within the constraints of international law, that's a huge distinction with huge consequences. If the United States obeyed international law, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 could never have taken place. If it worked in a framework of cooperation, that invasion never could have taken place because Europe wouldn't have gone along with it. They just had Britain, they didn't have France, they didn't have Germany. So it would be true if you say, well, what's the difference if you're unilateral or multilateral, if you're doing the same thing? But the fact is that if you're multilateral, you can't do the same thing, depending on what kind of multilateral you are. Certainly, if you operate within the constraints of international law, you can't do the same thing. You can't invade countries that haven't attacked you without the authorization of the UN Security Council. So I think that even though I agree to some extent, although it's hard to know how much importance to attach to that kind of rhetoric, as they say, we need to restore American leadership in the world. Well, that's a pretty broad, vague thing, and that could cover a lot of ground. Maybe you mean trying to expand the World Trade Organization, or maybe you mean spending more money on addressing AIDS in Africa, or trying to meet the UN Millennium Goal of cutting poverty in half. People, even kind of left liberals in Washington, use this kind of rhetoric when they're trying to get the United States to do good things. They say, you need to give this money for AIDS and education in order to restore U.S. leadership. So the fact that they're talking about, knowing that, the fact that they're talking about restoring U.S. leadership, I don't have exactly the same reaction as some other people on the left, because, if what they mean by restoring U.S. leadership is that we're going to, increase U.S. assistance to deal with AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and we're going to really make sure that the UN development goals are met of having poverty and universal access to primary education. Well, if that's what you mean by restoring U.S. leadership in the world, sign me up.
We're speaking to Bob Nayman. He's at outside the DNC, the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado. It's just around 7 o'clock here on WORFU LP Urbana. We're going to take a brief break and come back talking to Bob again directly after this.
You're listening to A Critical Ear on WORFU Urbana, an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WORFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or Urbana Socialist Forum. You too can have a show on WORFU.
Go to WRFU.net or RadioFreeUrbana.org for details. More information on A Critical Ear, including podcasts and further discussion of topics raised on air, at our website, acriticalear.info.
And that's talking there with, or sorry, that was our,
that was our midpoint piece telling you what you're listening to. We're back talking to Bob Naiman. That's what we're doing. Bob, you mentioned earlier the Iraq Veterans Against the War, and they're present there in Denver, and they've taken part in some actions in order to, as they put it, bring Baghdad to Denver's sidewalks. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is an action that some people may be familiar with because they've done it before in other places and times. But it's where they try to give Americans a little taste of what it's like to live under foreign military occupation. So they have a bunch of volunteers who pretend to be Iraqi civilians, and then they, you know, treat the volunteers, the American volunteers who are pretending to be Iraqi civilians, as if they were Iraqi in Iraq. And they actually, they got some favorable press coverage in Denver out of that. So again, I think, you know, they've done this action before in Washington and gotten kind of unfavorable coverage. So maybe this is an argument that for getting outside of Washington into the heartland where the media isn't necessarily as hostile. Because I think the Denver media has been relatively positive towards and open-minded towards the protests. And even the, you know, the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News had the video on their website of the IVAW march to the Pepsi Center, which was very, very positive coverage. So I would say that IVAW has done very well in getting their message out into the local media here.
I saw a video online. I'm not sure if it was of an IVAW event or perhaps the event you've just described, of people being subjected to interrogation techniques.
That's IVAW. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a rather disturbing piece of video, even though it's clear that it's clear it's being staged. It's clear what that it's a demonstration of something. But it's does. It does draw your attention, shall we say?
Yes, it is disturbing. You know, even the simulation, it's hard to watch.
Mm-hmm. What other we've talked a little bit about Iraq and Iran, and there are obviously issues that for you are at the forefront of issues you work on a day by day basis. What sort of other issues have you seen raised by activists at the convention that drew your attention, that kind of made you stop and think, or that you think might be of interest to our listeners?
Well, certainly people here are very concerned about civil liberties. There was a protest organized by Code Pink earlier this week, at an event that AT&T sponsored. It was a reception or a tribute to the Blue Dogs, and of course these are the by their own description more conservative Democrats in the House who played a critical role. Actually, played a critical role in all bad things. You know, played a critical role in continuing to fund the war and were very reluctant to support a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq, and also were the first to move towards the so-called compromise on the FISA litigation.
This is immunity.
Retroactive immunity for the
telecommunication
companies. These were companies that the Bush administration asked to provide data from Americans' phone calls in violation of law because they didn't have court authorization as they're supposed to under the law. Position of the Bush administration was, you know, well, we're the government, and we asked them, and of course they should do this, and that was the position of the companies too. Well, the government asked them, regardless of whether it was legal or not. Then the
which, if I may, if I may just say there, which is of course a facile argument, because the telecommunication companies are already familiar with the fact that if they are to tap a phone line, they need court authorization. They need a warrant. So to kind of say the government came to us, asked us for information, and we knew no better. This is the situation. They already know that if the government asks you for information as part of an investigation,
if the police ask you to do something illegal, it's still illegal.
Yeah.
And if the government asks you to do something illegal, it's still illegal.
So anyhow, so the Congress made on foot of Bush administration requests, made moves to indemnify.
So eventually they passed the so-called compromise, which gave the Bush administration largely what they wanted, and also gave the telecommunications companies largely what they wanted, which was retroactive immunity for having violated the law. There was a class action civil lawsuit underway against the companies for carrying out this policy, and the companies were very eager to make this lawsuit go away. So they got Congress to do this, and it's been documented that there was a high correlation between this policy shift of the Congress going along with this retroactive immunity and increased contributions from the telecommunications company. So here in Denver, when AT&T has this bash, this party for the Blue Dogs, that was considered by many activists provocation, because people are still mad about the...
Well, it's just a crass form of bribery as opposed to the more sophisticated laundering through campaign donations you usually get.
Well, it's really all the same. It's just, I don't know if that's... One is more crass than the other.
I'll cede you that, Bob.
For the campaign contribution, it all seems kind of equally crass. I think actually the other is more crass. It's just a party, right? The campaign contribution, that's the fuel of Washington, right? That's how you get reelected. So if you want to get reelected, you need campaign contributions. So if some company comes and contributes to your campaign, then you're going to like them a lot. You know, the party, you could take or leave. You probably, a lot of the people, I didn't get in, I tried to get in. I didn't have a ticket. The report that I got afterwards was that, you know, a lot of people that are in there, they were not even, they weren't even members of Congress or their staff. You know, they were lobbyists for NGOs that are just trying to be wherever the action is. So like people that are lobbying for Head Start. So the members of Congress and their staff, they can take or leave these parties, but they can't take or leave the, under our current campaign finance law, they can't take or leave the campaign contribution. So that, I think that's where the real action is. But seeing these people celebrated by their paymasters, you know, that's certainly a provocation.
Okay. One of the other things you mentioned civil liberties, and one of the things that there have been reports of earlier today is of police raids at the center for the independent media center space in downtown Denver or in the Denver area. Have you heard anything about that? Last I heard, there had been a raid, and then a number of individuals had been arrested at that.
No, I had not heard that.
Okay.
I don't have any information about that.
Well, we'll try to, if I can find extra information after this, I'll make sure to link to it from our website, wrfu.net. Bob, obviously you're in Denver. A lot of your attention this past week has been focused on events in Denver, but the world continues.
I got the Just Foreign Policy News out every day this week.
Yes, you have. And, you know, and So my question was, of those events that are happening elsewhere in the world that people may be distracted from due to the focus on the spectacular that is the DNC, what would you say people should know about in the past week? And we've about 4 minutes left in the show.
Well, a couple of things. You mentioned, I won't say much about this because you were talking about this when you brought me on, but I do think that the... the successful running of the blockade of Gaza or the Free Gaza movement is really one of the high points of my week. They did not face arrest. It was reported today that Jeff Halper, who is from the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, who was the one Israeli on the trip, had been arrested yesterday by the Israeli police for violating the Israeli orders, law, military orders that Israelis aren't allowed to go to Gaza. He was released today on bond. So the Free Gaza movement is obviously very happy. They feel like they've successfully run the blockade, and they're hoping that this will be an example to others, the Arab League, the Arab countries, other international organizations, to send more humanitarian aid directly to Gaza. And they also brought back with them, according to their press release today, to Cyprus, Palestinians who need medical treatment. So I'm hopeful. I hope they're right, that this is the beginning of the end of the blockade. We'll see. The negotiations continue between the U.S. and Iraq on the
what is now a status of forces agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that continues to be positive in the sense that the Iraqi government continues to assert very sharply its demand that there be a firm timetable for withdrawal of all forces. That's what the Iraqi government, Prime Minister Maliki, is saying. You could say some of that's posturing, but it's still very good. It has a great effect on the overall discussion. At the same time that in the U.S., you know, Senator McCain and the Bush administration have been trying to make fun of those who want a timetable for withdrawal, saying, oh, you want to cut and run. Well, this is what the Iraqi government, you know, our friends, the Iraqi government, they want the same thing.
The people the U.S. claims to be helping.
We're supporting Iraqi sovereignty. So that's very positive. Another interesting development is that the Afghan government is getting into the act. They want an agreement on governing U.S. military forces. And, of course, the context this is happening is not just seeing what the Iraqis are accomplishing, but also the widespread outrage in Afghanistan over civilian casualties as a result of U.S. airstrikes, again exacerbated in the last week by this report of 90 civilian deaths, which has had, that's the report of Afghan local officials, but also some confirmation of that by the United Nations. So the Afghan officials are starting to talk about, you know, we need an agreement. Right now there's just this little memo that they had. They don't have an actual agreement governing U.S. forces. So I hope that that will, that's something that, you know, many people in the U.S., many peace activists, have been thinking for a while, you know, we should be doing something in Afghanistan. What should we do? Well, that's something that people could be pushing on. You know, here's the government that the United States has set up in Afghanistan is saying, we want an agreement, like the Iraqis have, over the activities of U.S. forces in Iraq. This is something that, you know, all right people, all right-thinking people should support, that the Afghan government should have some say in what U.S. troops are doing in their supposedly sovereign country.
Okay, unfortunately, that is all the time we have to speak with Bob today. We'll be talking with Bob live from the Republican National Convention, or outside the Republican National Convention, this time next week. Do stay tuned to WRFU.net.
A Critical Ear presents news and commentary about a range of topical issues, from international affairs to the labor movement. It is produced and broadcast from the studios of WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. Our website includes show archives and further discussion of topics discussed on air. For more information, go to acriticalear.info or contact us by email at show@acriticalear.info. Twitter updates at acriticalear. Views expressed on A Critical Ear are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or Urbana Socialist Forum. WRFU LP Urbana on 104.5 FM, your community radio station.